Welcome to Between the Lines, presenting news and analysis of critical issues affecting our region, the nation, and the world. This week we present Nancy Lesson of the group Military Families Speak Out, who assesses anti-war protests marking the second anniversary of the U.S. invasion of Iraq. José Bové, a French farmer and leader of the anti-corporate globalization movement, who discusses the International Farmers Coalition Via Campesina and the struggle against industrial agriculture. And Elliot Mintzberg of People for the American Way, who examines the Republican Party's likely attempt to abolish the filibuster in the U.S. Senate. But first, we begin with a summary of some of the week's underreported news stories.
Pakistan is still trying to use its connections on the nuclear black market to upgrade its stockpile of weapons of mass destruction. According to Reuters, the illicit moves by Pakistan were discussed in an early March meeting of the 44-nation nuclear suppliers group in Vienna. This comes 2 years after the arrest of Pakistan's top nuclear scientist, Abdul Qadan Khan, who ran an illegal network that sold nuclear technology to Iran and Libya. But Pakistan has prevented U.S. investigators from interviewing Khan, who remains under house arrest. According to the New York Times, Khan had sold engineering secrets useful in fabricating nuclear warheads. Unnamed sources told Reuters that the recent Pakistan initiative involved two middlemen who were not part of Khan's earlier deals. Pakistan first detonated a nuclear weapon in 1998 and has never signed the Nuclear Non-Proliferation Treaty, or NPT, which would make it subject to sanctions. The nuclear black market issue is expected to dominate the upcoming NPT review conference at the United Nations in May. Former UN Weapons Inspector David Albright, who runs the Institute for Science and International Security, says European nations put out a warning about Pakistan in 2004 that its operatives were shopping around for high-strength aluminum for gas centrifuges to make nuclear fuel. South African community activist Sajita Khan has fought for years to close an apartheid-era dump site near Durban. According to the Washington Post, Khan now faces a new set of obstacles from the Kyoto Protocol on global warming, which allows industrialized nations to buy carbon credits from less polluting nations, which only creates the illusion of emissions reduction. The World Bank is financing a project that will use methane gas leaking at the Durban dump site and use it to make electricity. Ken Newcomb, director of the World Bank's Prototype Carbon Fund, says the project will cut greenhouse gases, produce clean energy, and filter the toxic methane. But Sajita Khan, who has survived two bouts of cancer and lives right next to the dump site, says other gases like benzene and formaldehyde will be spewed into the environment by the power plants. She says the dump should be closed, with a buffer zone around it, and that local residents should be relocated at government and corporate expense. World Bank critics, such as the U.S.-based Institute for Policy Studies, say carbon trading, which could reach a $250 billion market value by the year 2008, is nothing more than global apartheid, pitting rich investors against people in poor nations who are suffering the effects of environmental pollution. Earlier this year, New York Senator Hillary Clinton, who many speculate will run for president in 2008, moved to soften her public profile by talking more openly about God and seeking a middle ground on abortion rights. On January 19th, Senator Clinton traveled to Boston to give a speech before 500 people honoring a youth outreach program run by Reverend Eugene Rivers III. Rivers is one of the most strident foes in Massachusetts of same-sex marriage, which was legalized in 2004 by the state Supreme Judicial Court. According to the Village Voice, Clinton's appearance before the large crowd filled with black ministers upset many gay activists in Boston and New York. Sean Cahill, a staffer with the National Gay and Lesbian Task Force Policy Institute, wrote a letter to the Boston Globe after the Clinton speech attacking Reverend Rivers as a demagogue with a history of trying to pit gay people and people of color against one another. Clinton spokesperson Philippe Raines says the senator was not aware of Rivers' hostile views towards same-sex marriage before giving the speech. He said Clinton had been a supporter of civil unions for gays, but has opposed same-sex marriage. Last year, Senator Clinton voted against the federal marriage amendment that would have placed a constitutional ban on gay marriage. This week's news summary was compiled by Bob Nixon. For Between the Lines, I'm Archibald Curry.
Years after President Bush made the decision to invade Iraq, in defiance of international law and world opinion, Americans have turned against the war. A poll conducted by The Washington Post and ABC News in early March found that 53% of Americans said the war was not worth fighting, while 70% believed U.S. casualties, including more than 1,500 deaths, was an unacceptable price to pay. More than half of those surveyed believed, overall, the U.S. war in Iraq was a mistake. On the weekend marking the second anniversary of the war, protests demanding an end to the U.S. occupation and the withdrawal of American troops were held across the world and the nation. Although smaller than similar demonstrations last year, anti-war protests and vigils were held in major cities in Europe, Asia, and Australia. In the U.S., more than 800 events were organized, with tens of thousands of citizens opposed to the war participating in cities large and small. A demonstration in Fayetteville, North Carolina, home to the U.S. Army's Fort Bragg and five other military bases, drew 5,000 to an anti-war rally sponsored by Military Families Speak Out, Iraq Veterans Against the War, and Gold Star Families for Peace. Many veterans and family members who lost loved ones in the war that attended the Fayetteville protest expressed strong support for the troops while insisting they be brought home. Between the Lines, Scott Harris spoke with Military Families Speak Out co-founder Nancy Lesson, whose own son had been deployed to Iraq. She discusses the importance of the Fayetteville protest and the state of the anti-war movement across the nation.
Fayetteville, North Carolina is the home of Fort Bragg, which is one of the largest military bases in the country. And Military Families Speak Out members who live on Fort Bragg or live in the Fayetteville area invited military families from across the country to join them on this second anniversary of a war that should never have happened, to do the largest support the troops, bring them home now rally on a base town, really in the history of the country. And so what ended up happening was we had about 100 military families who came in from as far away as Hawaii and as close as right on the base there at Fort Bragg. Iraq Veterans Against the War turned out in great numbers. Vietnam Veterans Against the War and Veterans for Peace came from all over the country, and we ended up with about 5,000 people from the military and ex-military community, as well as the North Carolina Peace and Justice community, as well as peace and justice organizations from around the country, sent people right to this base town to deliver the message in the strongest way that we could, which is end the occupation, bring the troops home now, take care of them when they get here, and never, ever send our loved ones and our troops into reckless military misadventures. And it was an incredible event.
What was the reaction among the military families who live in and around Fayetteville?
Well, a number of them joined us. We had wives who had never marched or demonstrated before. One military wife from Fort Bragg, whose husband was leaving in 2 days for Iraq, came and joined us. Another wife whose husband is in Iraq joined us, and they met for the first time other wives who were speaking out against the war. It was just an incredible scene. I think the demonstrations marked a very important time, the second anniversary of a war that should never have started. But there are so many things that are going on right now that may be under the radar screen of some of the media, but are very, very important in building a movement. And that's what we're doing here. We don't believe that it's ever been a politician that's ended a war. It's been a social movement. And this social movement that includes military families, that includes returned Iraq war vets, that includes veterans from other conflicts, and includes many others, is growing.
Well put. Nancy, I wanted to ask you this. Since the January 30th Iraqi election, there's been a lot of triumphalism coming out of the White House and the U.S. corporate media, basically saying that the success of those elections vindicates George W. Bush's policy, to which they're accrediting a wave of democracy throughout the Middle East. So you have a lot of pundits in Washington and around the country who are basically saying, gee, this war might be a good thing in the long run. What do you think?
We've seen a lot of banner days come and go. The first one was May 1st, 2003. That was supposedly the end of major combat. Then we saw the capture of Saddam Hussein, and that was supposed to be some kind of a turning point. Then we saw the June 28th, 2004 transfer of paper or power or whatever that was, and that was supposed to be a turning point. And now we had some elections, and that was supposed to be a turning point. And here's what we know. There's 150,000 U.S. troops occupying Iraq right now. There are troops that are dying. There are Iraqis that are dying. The occupation continues to be the problem, not the solution. And it is continuing to be fuel on the fire. And we are going to continue to see the death of our loved ones, the death of Iraqis, continuing and worsening. There is no rebuilding that we see. One of our members said very eloquently, our soldiers cannot carry simultaneously a shovel and a gun. And what we very strongly believe is that what's needed now is to end the occupation, bring the troops home. We talk about taking care of them when they get here because of the massive amounts of post-traumatic stress disorder. And we also talk about the need for supporting the people of Iraq. There's a lot of rebuilding that does have to happen. We have littered the countryside there with depleted uranium that needs to be cleaned up, and we believe that there is a large responsibility that the United States has to the people of Iraq, but that's in the form of resources, not in the form of soldiers with guns, and it's certainly not in the form of Halliburton and Bechtel and the Carlyle Group.
That was Nancy Lesson of the group Military Families Speak Out. Call the group at area code 617-522-9323 or visit their website at www.mfso.org. José Bové is a French cheese farmer who gained notoriety in 1999 when he led other activists in destroying a McDonald's restaurant in France, for him a hated symbol of the industrialization of food production. Bové, who has also been arrested for destroying genetically modified or GM crops, has since become an international leader of the anti-corporate globalization movement. He was recently in the U.S., just back from visiting survivors of the tsunami disaster in Indonesia and participating in the World Social Forum in Brazil. He heads the Confédération Paysanne, the French Farmers Union, which is part of Via Campesina, an international farmers movement with millions of members. Between the Lines, Melinda Tuhus spoke with Bové at the winter conference of the Connecticut chapter of NOFA, the Northeast Organic Farming Association, March 5th. He discusses the origin of Via Campesina, the international farmers' movement, in response to free trade agreements, rulings by the World Trade Organization, or WTO, and the struggle for food sovereignty in Europe and around the world.
Well, the Via Campesina works on different issues, double fights, to defend, to support the farmers all over the world. And we're fighting mostly to have a new right to be recognized by the international institution, and this right is food sovereignty. What happens now is that the transnational corporation oblige the countries to open their borders to importation of food dumping importations. And mostly the United States and Europe are trying to impose this in WTO. So in this moment, this thing is completely crazy because this is destroying all agriculture over the world and the capacity of the countries to be able to feed their own population. Via Campesina was part of the movements who win the Battle of Seattle, and also last year in Cancun, when for the second time WTO couldn't have any results. So we try to make more and more links between the social movements and the developing countries to stop the going up of WTO and other international negotiation as a regional negotiation, as you have here for America, or we have between Europe and Africa and so on. And also it's very important for us as European farmers. We are fighting also to be able to have our own European policy for agriculture and to be able to feed our own population.
Is there a subset of organic farmers within the Via Campesina? I assume not everyone is an organic farmer.
No, in Via Campesina, all the farmers are not organic farmers. But what is quite new is that in a lot of countries now, organic farming is beginning the way as the movement try to win with autonomy for the farmers in front of the big companies. And so it's beginning to be a way of resistance. It's a new way to resist in front of the companies. Little farmers don't have to have so many money to buy all the inputs of industrial agriculture. So very often we see when there are settlements from people who have no land, and when they take some piece of land, they begin now trying directly to make organic farming. And this is, we see this very clearly in Asia, in Brazil, and in a lot of countries where this is a new way of fighting. So making organic agriculture is also a way to fight concretely against industrial food. After the tsunami on the 26th of December this last year, the social movement was the first to be there in Banda Aceh to help the people. And what was quite interesting is that the fact that the first food which was coming was organic rice, which has been given by the settlements of the landless people. And these people make organic rice since years now, and there were tons and tons of organic rice given to the population to eat. It was clear that it was from poor people to other poor people. And together, this was a very important thing. And when food was coming from outside of the country, from outside, from USA to other ones, the people said, we don't want this. We say we have enough food in our country to feed our own population. And when Bush fathers came 2 weeks ago in Indonesia, in Banda Aceh with Clinton, we made a demonstration the same day in Banda Aceh with the Minister of Agriculture from Indonesia, and we were cutting rice to explain that we had, in this country there was enough rice and we didn't need to have food coming from outside. Because they understand very clearly that if they open their borders, they're going to destroy all the agriculture of their country. What I think that we need to have more and more links between farmers, environmentalists, consumers from the both sides of the Atlantic Ocean. We have to have links together to fight for organic agriculture, to help the farmers to keep on their land, and also to fight against our governments who are making sometimes really big mistakes when they're going to go to make war to have oil.
That was José Bové, a French farmer and international leader of the anti-globalization movement. For more information, visit the Farmers Movement website at www.viacampesina.org. After victories in the 2004 election, the Republican Party in charge of the presidency, Congress, and a good part of the judiciary branch of government has become increasingly bold in pursuing its conservative agenda. In a string of controversial moves, President Bush has nominated John Bolton to become U.S. Ambassador to the United Nations and Deputy Secretary of Defense Paul Wolfowitz to move from the Pentagon to head the World Bank. This comes as the White House makes threats against Syria, advocates the privatization of Social Security, and proposes dramatic cuts in social programs while offering ever larger tax cuts to the wealthy. In the U.S. Senate, the Republican majority is threatening to use extraordinary parliamentary maneuvers to eliminate the filibuster, the Democrats' only tool to block lifetime judicial appointments they view as extremist. The GOP idea of abolishing the filibuster, a Senate institution for over 200 years, has infuriated Senate Democrats and led them to threaten non-cooperation in future legislative matters if the so-called nuclear option is approved. Between the Lines, Scott Harris spoke with Elliot Mintzberg, vice president and legal director with People for the American Way, who examines the plan to eliminate the filibuster and other unprecedented actions, such as congressional intervention in the life support case of Terry Schiavo. He explains how these political tactics have led some observers to conclude that the Republican majority is engaging in a gross abuse of power.
I do think that the Republican leadership in the House and the Senate has shown a disturbing willingness to use anything they can for political advantage, whether it is intervening in these life and death situations or breaking the rules of the game as they've been for hundreds of years in the Senate and the House, to do whatever they can for temporary partisan political advantage, even throwing aside the checks and balances that have made our country great. That's important even in the Schiavo case. It's the job of courts to adjudicate these kinds of terribly wrenching disputes and not to throw Congress in the middle of it.
The Senate Republicans under Majority Leader Bill Frist are contemplating a parliamentary maneuver to do away with the minority party's ability to filibuster and block judicial nominations and so on, the so-called nuclear option. Are the Republicans capable of pulling this off? And what are the Democrats' likely response?
Well, it's another example of what we're talking about, the willingness to bend or break the rules to achieve temporary political advantage. 214 nominees by President Bush were considered by the Senate over the first 4 years. A grand total of 10 were blocked by Democrats. That's less than 5% because they were so very extreme in nature, including a nominee, for example, from Texas, Priscilla Owen, who was so far to the right that even Alberto Gonzalez, when he was on the Texas Supreme Court with her, called an opinion of hers an example of outright judicial activism, for example. Because of this, because they didn't get 100%, they only got 95%, the Republicans are claiming that the use of filibusters breaks Senate rules when, in fact, it's exactly the opposite. For more than 200 years, the use of the filibuster or extended debate to block something, to make sure that the rights of the minority are protected, has been a hallmark of what we've seen in the United States Senate. And what some Republicans in the leadership are prepared to do is to break the rules in order to change the rules, to change them without following the usual procedures, but have a bare majority simply declare that the filibuster is out of bounds when it comes to judicial nominations. We're very hopeful that they won't be able to get the votes to do that. There are some moderate Republicans, such as Senator Chafee, who have come out against it. Some, such as Senator McCain, has said he has severe doubts about it. But we will probably find out sometime in April or May whether they can pull together the 50 votes to do this, frankly, naked power play to take away a safeguard that's been around for literally hundreds of years.
In the long run, what is the danger, in your view, to our system of government if the Republicans should succeed here? And aren't the Republicans in some way being short-sighted given the fact that they will someday be in the minority? Let's hope it's quite soon. And they, too, will be subjected to these rules changes.
Well, to take your second point first, you're absolutely right. And indeed, there have been a number of conservatives, people like George Will, former Senator Malcolm Wallop, who have come out against the nuclear option, who have said the filibuster is important because minorities and majorities shift. And the long-term consequence, in essence, would be to turn the Senate into just like the House, where a bare majority rules, where things can be pushed through on a just bare majority vote, the result of which is to severely harm the rights of the minority. And in the Senate, the minority of the Senate sometimes is actually the majority of the U.S. population when you consider that every state has two U.S. senators, and would be extremely destructive to the politics and to our basic systems of government. Not to mention, of course, that what it would do would be to give the president literally a blank check, at least in this Congress, for nominations not only to the lower federal courts, but to the Supreme Court. If all he needs are 50 out of 55 Republican votes, then President Bush could nominate Pat Robertson, John Ashcroft, or anybody else you please to the U.S. Supreme Court and easily get them confirmed.
Elliot, what tools do the Democrats have in the minority there in the U.S. Senate at 45 seats? What can they do to forestall this plan if it actually is executed?
Well, the most important tool they have, we hope, is the tool of persuasion and public opinion. The polls that have been taken on this, the ones that have been taken honestly, show that the majority of the American people are against this idea. And I think that Democrats in the Senate need to work even more at talking to their Republican brethren and persuading them that this is, in fact, a bad idea. But one of the reasons that it's called the nuclear option is that this kind of incredible abolition by whim, in essence, of one of the fundamental Senate rules is likely to literally blow up the Senate. Senator Reid, the majority leader, has made clear that while he certainly doesn't want to do this, if the Republicans are going to go through with this, the result may be to, in essence, shut down the Senate for much of the business that it does, not key things like appropriations and defense legislation, but the sort of cooperation, frankly, that Democrats have provided so far on legislation, some of which hasn't always gone the Democrats' way, whether it's class action legislation or other kinds of issues, is frankly not going to continue. And what Bill Frist has to do is to decide, does he want to exercise the nuclear option to satisfy the far-right base of the Republican Party, which he hopes will support him for election for president in 4 years, or does he want to get the business of the Senate done by preserving the basic rules and following the rules rather than violating them in order to change them?
That was Elliot Mintzberg, Vice President and Legal Director with People for the American Way. Contact the group by calling area code 202-467-4999. Or visit their website at www.pfaw.org. You've been listening to Between the Lines, a weekly program presenting news and analysis of critical issues affecting our region, the nation, and the world. Between the Lines is produced at the studios of WPKN Radio and distributed by Squeaky Wheel Productions. If you have suggestions for topics and guests, please contact Between the Lines by calling area code 203-331-9756 or write to Between the Lines, care of WPKN Radio, 244 University Avenue, Bridgeport, Connecticut, 06604. Visit our website at www.btlonline.org to hear our current and archived programs in MP3 and real audio. There, you can subscribe to free weekly program summaries and interview transcripts. Our theme music was written and performed by Mika Ta. This week's program is produced by Scott Harris with the assistance of Archibald Curry, Hank Hoffman, Anna Manzo, Harry Minot, Bob Nixon, Melinda Tuhus, and Jeff Yates. For Between the Lines, I'm Denise Manzari.